I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. I'm very pleased that my next guest is joining me now. He has written a remarkable book, and why wouldn't he, as he's writing about his remarkable parents, William F. Buckley, and the Vancouver-born Patricia Taylor Buckley. In 2007 and 2008, in the span of about 10 months, Mrs. Buckley died, followed by her husband, the father of the modern conservative movement in the United States, the popular columnist and commentator, founder of the National Review, and the host of Firing Line. Mrs. Buckley, who was the daughter of Austin Taylor, went on to become one of New York City's most glamorous and colorful socialites. Their only son, Christopher, has written a heartfelt, candid, honest, and touching book. Christopher Buckley is the author of 14 books, including Supreme Courtship, Florence of Arabia, Bloomsday, and Thank You for Smoking. He is editor-at-large of Forbes Life and has received the Thurber Prize for American Humor. The book, Losing Mum and Pup, is already a bestseller and is published here in Canada by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto this day, Christopher Buckley. Good morning, Mr. Buckley.
Well, good morning. It's funny to be speaking to you, who are in Vancouver, from Toronto, where I am, because my grandfather, whom you just mentioned, Austin Taylor, was from Toronto and moved to Vancouver in 1917. And he married along the way the daughter of the Winnipeg chief of police, grandmother, Babe Taylor. So we come full circle.
Yeah. Now, did your mom ever come back to Vancouver after she left here?
She came back while her parents were alive. My grandfather died in 1965. He lived on, they lived in an enormous house on Granville, 7255 Granville, called Shannon, which still exists and is used in as a movie set in a lot of movies. It's they built condominiums around the property. He died in 1965, and my grandmother died in 1972. So my mom would come back and visit them while they were alive, but her visits became fewer after that. She did have a brother, Austin G.E. Taylor, who was a big stockbroker at McLeod, Young & Weir, I think it was called. But anyway, but I come back because I have a very dear first cousin, Kathy Armstrong, who is it's funny, my Canadian grandparents had three children, all of whom married American Catholics. It's funny, and a lot of the third generation actually moved back to Vancouver. But so I still have ties, and it's a city that I absolutely love.
Your father was a well-known Catholic. Your mother was not religious, was she?
Well, she was formally religious. She was Anglican. She always used the word Anglican rather than Episcopalian.
It's a Canadian thing, I think.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, she would go to church on Easter Sunday and Christmas, that sort of thing. But Pup was a very, very, very Catholic indeed. They were very dissimilar in so many ways, and yet they somehow made interesting music together. They were from quite different backgrounds.
You write in the book that they throughout their marriage, about a third of their marriage, they never spoke to one another.
Well, it would probably be more accurate had I said that for about a third of it, she wasn't speaking to him.
What was the problem with?
They were both very big personalities. You know, they were both, to use that terrible cliche, larger than life, and which is to say they were, you know, they could be occasionally impossible, and he could be very frustrating. You know, because it always had to be sort of his way, and that made her very frustrated. But at the same time, she even if she wasn't speaking to him, she would, you know, pack his bags, make sure he had everything for a trip or whatever, because she was raised by her mother in an age when that's what you did. You know, you took care of your man, However, even if you weren't speaking to him, things have somewhat changed today.
She was also mendacious. She told tall tales.
She told tall tales. Yeah, she would. She had, which was, I think, part of a very active imagination. She could have, you know, I often wished and urged her to write, because she would have. She was such an amazing storyteller, and that I think had she put pen to paper, she could have been an amazing novelist. But she just didn't have that inclination, and so she put that energy into conversation, and sometimes it was just outrageous, because she would make up, you know, the most outrageous stories. But it was never dull. I'll say that it was never dull.
She told a friend of your daughter's, who was related to the Kennedys, that she was a juror in the Skakel case.
Yeah, she did stuff like that. I was so glad not to have been there for that.
Yeah.
There were, you know, hundreds of those incidents. And she also had this weird confidence, Mom. She would, you know, Henry Kissinger was a great friend of theirs, and he would be at the dinner table talking about, you know, the latest Middle East peace proposal or whatever. And she was perfectly capable of stopping Henry Kissinger in mid-sentence to inform him that he knew absolutely nothing about the Middle East. And such was her aura of authority that he would just stare into his borscht, and she was like something out of Noel Coward, Mom. You know, she was really a fascinating woman. She could be terribly naughty at times, but my mom was quite a piece of work.
And she was a striking woman. You look at the photos of her.
You know, she never took a bad picture. I went, when I was preparing the, we used to call them slideshows, now we call them PowerPoint presentations, but for her memorial service at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, I went through to do basically, as I say, the slideshow set to music. I went through literally thousands of photographs of her, and you know, she never took a bad photo. She was the camera, you know, the expression, the camera loved her. The camera just loved her. Well, she was a striking woman, you know. She stood almost 6 foot tall. She had legs that went on forever. She had strange to talk about one's mother in these terms, but Woman's Wear Daily, the fashion daily newspaper of New York, once referred to her chest as a belle poitrine. This being Canada, of course, we're all bilingual here, and so you know exactly what that means. But
right.
It means, you know, great chest. So she had an amazing figure. And her friends in New York included people like Bill Blass and Oscar de la Renta, you know, Halston, famous fashion designers. And they loved to dress her, and because, you know, she made their stuff look so good. She was a striking lady.
There was a story in the book where I guess she dropped you off at school, and your friends at school, or the older kids, I guess, at school, called her a piece of ass.
Yeah, which I took, you know, as sort of an insult, and ended up in a fist fight, and then the guy said, no, you know, he actually meant it as a compliment, but it's when you're 13, they sound like fighting words.
You have a footnote at the bottom of the page that made me laugh out loud. You write that it'd be akin today to kids calling a mom a MILF.
Oh, yeah, well... Right.
I just thought it was hilarious.
I think I say, but let's not go there.
Yeah, right, correct. And let's not, then. You talk about putting that montage together, and I was, in reading it, I was wondering why you chose the two songs that you did. Michael Feinstein's Isn't It Romantic, and Where Do You Start?
Well, because they're just hauntingly beautiful covers of old songs, and I did it. It's quite amazing PowerPoints where you can precisely position a photo against a song, so that there's a little in the song, "Isn't It Romantic?" There's a little bit of a non-melody lead up for about 45 seconds, and then he segues into "Isn't It Romantic?" And at that point, I had their wedding photos from Vancouver from July 6, 1950. So it was, I was able to give the photos a certain rhythm, if you will. It was quite a wedding, you know. It was up to that point. I don't know what's happened since. I'm sure there have been big weddings in Vancouver, but at the time, it was the biggest wedding in Vancouver's history. There were 1,000 guests, and the reception was held in the gardens at Shannon, which was, it looked like a movie set, and it was really, really, really quite something. I think my grandfather took over the Hotel Vancouver for the week to put, you know, everyone up. But, a few people are still alive who were at that wedding, and they're still talking about it.
Yeah, they are, yeah. Why do you think this book has resonated with people so much?
Well, I'd like to think because it's, you know, a well-written book, but it's probably because it's about a universal experience. I mean, losing one's parents, we all go through this. I am of the boomer generation, as perhaps are you. There's 77 million of us, and we're now in that age envelope where this is happening. I think the statistics are that the generation of my parents' generation are leaving us now at the rate of about 1,000 a day. So it's happening to everyone, and I've had really quite an overwhelming response to the book, and almost 90% of them in the second sentence or second paragraph, if it's an email, start talking about their own experiences. You know, they say, "Oh, you know, I lost my mom last year," or "My parents went together 5 years ago." So I think it just touched a universal chord, if you will.
People wanted to read, I guess, about William Buckley's last days as well, and people were interested in that. And you write in the book, it seems to me that he was ready to die. Was that your sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he wasn't just a sense. He said it publicly. He said it on the Charlie Rose TV show about 3 years ago. I don't mean to laugh. It was kind of a poignant moment. But Pup was, you know, he was a devout Catholic. He believed, you know, very, very firmly in an afterlife. So he had that, call it consolation, if you will. And he had pretty much done everything he set out to do. You know, he did enough for several lifetimes. He started a political movement that eventually, you know, put Ronald Reagan in the White House. He wrote 55 books. He wrote 6,000 columns. He 1,500 episodes of Firing Line. You know, hundreds of freelance magazine articles, newspaper pieces. So there wasn't anything he sort of had left undone. And I think part of, and I sort of bear that in mind in my own life. I mean, I haven't done one-fifth of what, or one-tenth of what he accomplished. But I think the secret, and I talk about it in the book, and I quote, I think it's Montaigne who said that the labor of one's life should be to build one's house of death, Now that sounds a bit grim, but if you think about it, what Montaigne is saying that we should prepare ourselves all our life for dying, and I think and aim toward that, make it a goal rather than something to be feared, because it's inevitable. So I think the secret of happiness or contentment or peace, call it what you will, is to accomplish the things that one can, and then embrace the inevitable rather than try to flee from it. So in that sense, Pop, you know, was a completed man, and he had no qualms, no fears about death. And because we all, you know, some of us just live too long. He had emphysema, and I mean, if he had died 5 years ago, say, of something else like a heart attack or whatever, he would have been spared the unpleasant ordeal of emphysema, which is a terrible disease, and all those other indignities that accompany often the last chapter of life.
He confided in Sam Tannenhaus, the New York Times book editor and your father's biographer, that he'd thought of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, had you been in Tannenhaus's position, were you a journalist at the time, would you have written a story about William F. Buckley considering suicide?
Well, I tell that story in the book. About 2 days after Pup died, Sam called me. I was getting busy with, you know, going to see the lawyers, and it was an emotional time. He'd only been dead 2 days. And Sam called and he said, well, look, I just wanted to run something by you, something I've written for the newspaper. And he said that he had had dinner with my dad about a month before, and the Pop had told him that he had contemplated suicide, and that he had talked to two priests about it, and that the two priests had told him that while the Catholic Church would regard it as a sin, they would regard it as a forgivable sin. And I said to Sam, well, you mean you've already written this story for the New York Times? And he said, well, yeah. And what worried me was that, I knew Sam to be an honorable and honest guy who gets his facts straight, but what worried me was in the age of the internet, pardon me, you run a story like that through the internet and the blogosphere, and 30 seconds later, you know, it's going to be, you know, William F. Buckley killed himself, which would be A, inaccurate, and B, something I would spend the rest of my life having to contradict. So I said to Sam, I said, well, look, Sam, I don't doubt that he told you that, but I think he told you that in your capacity as his biographer, as his official biographer. And it's one thing if you tell that story, which you have every right to do, on page 684 of your book. But it's another thing to write it as a news story. He was not telling you this in any capacity as a New York Times reporter. And Sam said, well, you know, yes, that may be, but I'm getting certain pressures here to write this story. And at this point, I thought, well, I think I have to pull out my ultimate sanction, which is I'm Pup's literary executor, and as such, I control access to Pup's papers in the archive at Yale University. So I said, well, Sam, I think I understand you're under pressure, but I think you're going to have to weigh those pressures against certain other ones. And he said, "Well, thank you. Let me sort it out." And a few hours later, he sorted it out, and I think agreed with me that that Pop had been speaking to him in his capacity as biographer and not reporter. And I tell this story in the book, and make no bones about the fact that Pop wanted to die. You know, he was in pain, he was suffering, he had emphysema, diabetes, sleep apnea, and, you know, all those dozens of other terrible things that accompany old age. And he missed his wife, you know. He missed Mom. He was good to go. And anyway, one day he went, sitting at his desk, working on his last book. So he died, as we say in Texas, with his boots on.
Your father's father was born in Texas, was he?
Well, my father's father was born in San Diego, Texas, and he was the son of a Texas sheriff. And the Texas sheriff was born in Canada, was born in Ontario.
Really?
Yeah, because his father had left Ireland in the 1840s because he had married a Catholic. And he had to leave. And so they came to Ontario. He was a sheep farmer. And they had a child, but the child had asthma. So they moved to a drier climate in Texas. And the child with asthma grew up to be a Texas sheriff. That was my father's grandfather. So my roots in Canada go back quite a ways, actually.
They do, don't they? Yeah.
Now,
you talk in the book as well about this crucifix that he had built in front of the house.
Right.
How tall was it?
Well, it was about 6 foot tall. It was a bronze crucifix, very artistic. It was he commissioned it from a sculptor named Jimmy Knowles, who was a wonderful sculptor. And he put it smack in the middle of Mom's rose garden, which didn't please her. And the idea was that their ashes, after they died, would go inside the cross and would remain there for all eternity. And Mom, Pop would talk about this sort of longingly, almost, at the dinner table. "Oh, Ducky, isn't it wonderful that our ashes will be together?" And Mom was having none of this, and she would lean over and whisper to me, "Just send me out with the garbage, or send me out with the tide. I most certainly do not wish to spend eternity in that object." But Mom went first, so she went into the cross. But I had this dilemma, see, because I was pretty sure I wouldn't be able to hold on to the house after death taxes and all the rest. As just about a month before, so I thought, you know, well, what's going to happen with the cross? So about a month before Pup died, I didn't really want to pester him with this because he had the other, you know, but it was a logistical, there was a logistical imperative, you might say. And I said, "Well, Pup, you know, what? I know you want your ashes in the cross after you're gone." He said, "Oh, I absolutely want them in the cross." I said, "Yeah, no, I know. I was just thinking, what if I had to, like, sell the house?" And he looked at me and said, "Your point being?" And I said, "Well, you know, a new owner might not want a 6-foot-high crucifix in the garden." And he said, "Why not? It's a work of art." I said, "Well, no, yeah, it is absolutely a work of art. But, you know, the new owner might be, I don't know, Jewish or Muslim, Amish."
Yeah.
He didn't want to talk about it. So I said, "Okay, well, we don't have to talk about it." So when he died, I made a, you might say, an executive decision and decided not to cremate him. But I'm Irish, and we Irish sort of have a thing about the body, and having, so you can, you know, have a wake, an excuse to have a last drinks party. And so I put Mom's ashes in the coffin with him, along with a jar of peanut butter. He loved peanut butter. And the TV remote control, which I knew would make him happy for all eternity, since he loved to hold on to that TV remote control. And so they're together in this cemetery in Sharon, Connecticut, where he grew up. And the cross is right there next to them.
Do you think you'd have been pleased by what happened?
I think it was, well, no. because those were his absolute wishes. But I think given the reality, you know, I feel at peace with the solution. And it made the family, the Buckley family, happy to have him back in Sharon, where he grew up. And his, you know, four of his sisters are buried there, so he's kind of where he belongs, and Mom is there with him on his lap. So I think it was an elegant solution. Yeah.
Why didn't she like going to Sharon?
You did read the book closely.
I did. Yeah.
well, it wasn't her scene. I guess you could say it was all Buckley's, and you know she just sort of stopped going to Sharon about 20 years ago, and I when I took the coffin up there with Mom in it and gave the eulogy in the Sharon Church to a congregation entirely of Buckley family members, I said that this was really the only way I could have gotten Mom back to Sharon, and the whole place just exploded with laughter. It was a very good laugh we all had. But anyway,
what's a book of your father's that we must read if we haven't read anything by William F. Buckley yet?
The book I would recommend is a wonderful anthology of his stuff. And it's very autobiographical and personal. It's not so much the political stuff. And it's called Miles Gone By. And it's very available. It's in print. I think even still in hardcover, but very definitely in paperback. And it's really a wonderful book, full of wonderful stories about his life, which was rich beyond measure, I must say. How he lived.
Now I'm in my mid 20s, so I'm of a generation that uses YouTube a lot. And
sure.
If someone didn't know William F. Buckley and they looked him up on YouTube, the two most viewed clips are of him debating Chomsky, and the other clip, the infamous one with Gore Vidal.
Oh, with Gore Vidal.
Yeah.
Right.
And so in both clips, he threatens them both. Was he a violent man?
No, not in the least. The Vidal episode was completely out of nature. Vidal was a nasty piece of work, and he provoked him by, calling him a Nazi. I don't remember the Chomsky one. Pup was, the least violent person I know, and he was famous for having a TV show that set the gold standard for civility and reasoned discourse. A lot of the TV today is perhaps not of that same standard, but he had absolutely everyone on that TV show, and I think it's still thought of as having set a very high standard for intellectual discussion. So no, he was a very peaceful guy and the most generous man I knew. Who he did so many kind things that people don't even know about. So I don't know, the Firing Line collection is at the Hoover Institute, and your question prompts me to. As his executor, to try to figure out how to make some of those tapes more available, because they're really quite fascinating. He had absolutely everyone on.
Yeah, like a DVD or something.
Yeah, something like that. I'm certain it already exists in some form, but I'll look into that. Thanks for the prompt.
Finally, about a week or so ago, I bought the first season of Mr. Belvedere. and Christopher Hewitt.
Oh yeah,
was a great friend of your parents.
Christopher Hewitt, who we did a wonderful guy, and we did when I was six a home movie one day. It was a parody of the Anastasia story, the Russian princess.
Right.
And it was called Anastasia. And it was shot, you know, with like a 16-millimeter black and white camera. And the dialogue was done the way they did in silent movies with, you know, words on a blackboard.
Right.
And intercut. And Christopher Hewitt played, of course, the Grand Duchess Anastasia. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a man in women's clothing. And he really, I mean, he really looked like the Grand Duchess. And I remember that scene to this day. They shot it a couple of times with him coming down the staircase, you know, holding, you know, I was the idiot younger brother or something. And I was holding his train as he came down the stairs.
You were paid a dollar, right?
I was paid a dollar for my day's work. I suppose don't tell Actors Equity, or they'll want their 20% or whatever it is.
Christopher, this has been just a pleasure to talk to you, and this is a magnificent book. It's a special book. Congratulations on it. I would say good luck, but you don't really need it anymore.
Oh, no, we all need luck. And anyway, give my best to my favorite city, Vancouver, and I'll be out there soon.
Will do. Thanks for joining us today.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. The book is called Losing Mom and Pup. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. Its author, the great Christopher Buckley, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.